It is Tuesday, January 24th, 1988. A gorgeous, beautiful Hawaiian morning at 2711 Honua Street in Manoa Valley, the home of Robert Wakefield Mist, a past president of the Outrigger Canoe Club. I am Ward Russell, also a past president of the club, and currently a member of the historical committee of the club. This committee has for some time been conducting oral interviews with prominent members of the club, and the purpose of my visit this morning is to conduct an oral interview with Wakey. We are in Wakey's bedroom because, as many of you know, he is a quadriplegic, a result of an accident which he incurred some time ago, and I plan to cover this item in his agenda. Why don't we do that in our interview today? Why don't we do that right now? Wakey, tell us a little bit about your accident.
Well, it was a strange thing, Ward. I was swimming laps up in front of the Mauna Kea Beach Hotel, actually, to get in shape for the long-distance so-called rough water swim, which was coming up in a week or so, and nobody knows what happened. I was just swimming laps out in the bay, and the next thing anybody knows is they found me on the beach with a broken neck, and they kept me alive with CPR and finally flew me to Honolulu, and eventually I had my neck fused. And unfortunately, it damaged the spinal cord, so I've been a quadriplegic ever since, and completely dependent on a respirator to breathe. I can't breathe on my own, so if you hear a noise in the background, it's my respirator pumping away, but keeps me going anyway.
You know, I'm going to just make a little change in our prepared agenda here, and ask you to list some of the accomplishments that you've been able to achieve since you've had your accident, and which I think is truly remarkable. The books you've written, the letters you've written, the way you get around. Tell us a little bit about that, will you?
Well, Ward, when you're stuck in a spot like this, you have to do with what you've got. And I think one of the greatest things that ever happened to me was when my son gave me an IBM PC computer for Christmas about 6 years ago. And with a little ingenuity, I built a pedestal for it that I could prop the keyboard up on a flap so that it's vertical instead of horizontal, so I can punch the keyboard with a stick in my teeth. And I've learned to do a little one-finger typing, only it's a one-tooth typing, really, because I use my mouth for it. And as a result, I'm able to peck away and write on the computer. And it's been a great solace to me, and I've done a lot of writing in my lifetime anyway. So I now occupy myself, every day, actually. I spend a couple of hours a day peppering away on this thing. I've written a number of children's books for my grandchildren, and I've written a book of the history of my family and my own life here, and I just completed a story about my World War II experiences, and this keeps me out of trouble, gives me something to do during the day, and I've also kept active in local politics and so forth by writing letters to the paper and letters to our legislators, and, you know, trying to kind of keep up with the things I used to do before I got laid up. So it's I give a lot of credit to the IBM PC for keeping me from just vegetating.
Wakey, your accomplishments are absolutely miraculous. They're just remarkable. Now let's get back into some of the things concerning your background. What brought your family to Hawaii?
Your father? Well, that's an interesting story, Ward. My dad's family came out here in 1855. His grandfather was a prominent physician in Belfast, Ireland, and for reasons that I've never fully understood, apparently on the basis of a letter he got from his brother-in-law, from his wife's brother, who was Judge John Montgomery, and had come to the islands a couple of years earlier, wrote and said, you know, this was a great place, and why didn't they come out here? So, believe it or not, he left a very lucrative medical practice and a beautiful, rather impressive home in Belfast, and chartered a small sailing ship and put his family, his wife, his three daughters and one son, and two of his wife's sisters aboard with their family belongings and whatnot, and they sailed to Hawaii straight from Liverpool. Took them 202 days to get out here. They went around Cape Horn, the story is, 13 times, and got blown back 12 times and finally made it on the 13th try. And they arrived here, and he went into medical practice here and was soon physician to the royal family. They were very close friends of Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma. And the girls grew up here, and all three of them married guys out here. One married a Dowsett, one married a Green, and my grandmother married a young British naval officer who came out here on his warship, the Havana. And apparently they fell in love and I guess got engaged, and then he sailed away and didn't come back for 5 years. And when he finally came back, they were married and moved to England, raised part of their family there, and then he was stationed in Esquimalt, Canada, on Vancouver Island. And there's a funny story about that. He apparently was due for an advancement in rank, and his papers didn't come when he thought they should. And so he got miffed, and he wrote the Admiralty in London and resigned. And his letter of resignation went around the horn, and letter saying that he'd been promoted to captain came around the horn the other way. They passed each other. So by that time, the fat was in the fire, so he retired. And then they moved back to Honolulu. And that was about 1875, I guess. And then my dad, who was the youngest member of the family, was born after they moved back here. So he was born and grew up here. He was born down in Kaka'ako, as a matter of fact. He always used to say he was born in the back of Lewis and Cook's lumber yard, which is, you know, where the Department of Transportation is now.
Yeah.
And that was waterfront in those days. That was beach. And he was born in a home that his father had rented from, I guess, from the British government. It was prefabricated and shipped out here around the horn to house a scientific expedition that came out to study the transit of Venus. And it was always known as the Transit of Venus House. And he was born there, and then they moved up to Union Street, and then they ended up in Nuku'ono down on the Kuakini Street, Nuku'ono Stream area. And so my mother came out here originally as a young Stanford student. She was one of the first women to go to Stanford, I think. And she came out as a house guest of Lily Hart Gay. Her husband was Francis Gay, and she spent the summer on Kauai. And my dad, who had to leave school, he never went to college because his father died when he was 17 years old. He was his first job was a clerk in the Makaweli Plantation store, and somehow he met my mother. And shortly after that, they were married in California and came back here and lived all their life here. So the family goes back to 1855 on that side of the family, and my mother came out here in about 1913, I think it was, and met my dad. That's how we started off out here.
When were you born?
I was born 1921, right just two blocks down the road between Mono Road and Ferdinand Avenue. My dad built a home there.
Well, I remember the place called Bray.
I was born in the upstairs of that house. I guess in those days people didn't go to the hospital to have babies. So actually, my birthplace is just a couple of blocks from where I'm living now.
You had a couple of brothers, you had some sisters.
Just one sister, my sister Frances, who was 4 years older than I am, and she's now living in California. She's married and lives in Belvedere, San Francisco area.
And brothers?
No, I never had any. Just the two of us.
Just the two of you.
Yep.
What did your father do for the living? He's on the plantation?
Well, no. As a matter of fact, as I say, he went to work for Makaweli Plantation Store originally, and then he came back, and A&B had just started in those days, and he went to work for Alexander Baldwin as a dock clerk or shipping clerk or something of the sort. And he was with Alexander Baldwin for the next 35 years. He was with them for all of his business life, ended up as corporate secretary, and he finally retired in around 1935, I think, or something of that sort.
What about your mother? Was she just a housewife?
Yep. She was very active here, and all those things that women were active in those days. She was in the Red Cross during the war, and she was with the outdoor circle and active in school. We both went to Pinole School, and she was active in PTA and that sort of stuff. But she never was actually employed. She was a director of the Children's Hospital in the old days. That was one of her primary avocations when she wasn't at home.
I don't believe you mentioned her maiden name.
She was Marion Finney, and actually she was born in Lewiston, Maine, but moved when she was 2 or 3 years old out to California, and she was brought up in Redlands, California, where her father was a banker and a fruit rancher, and she had two brothers and a sister, all of whom lived in California.
A little bit about your schooling.
Well,
you went to Pinole.
Like everybody else, I started Pinole in first grade. I didn't go to Lanai School like so many of the other kids did, or Miss Maxwell's or whatever it was called in those days. I went right to Pinole School in first grade, and I was at Pinole until my ninth grade year. I completed ninth grade, and then my family decided that they better get me out of here. I'd be nothing but a surf bum and never learned to speak English. And so they sent me back to prep school in New England. And I always laughed about that because they said I had a typical local accent and I'd never get rid of it. And, it would hamper me for the rest of my life. And one of the prime examples of somebody that had never grown out of Pidgin English accent was Staff Austin, who later turned out to be my father-in-law.
Now, speaking about your father-in-law, tell us a little bit about your wife. Was she a Kamina?
Oh, she's very much a Kamina. She was of a missionary persuasion, and her family, original members of her family, came out here in 1826. Her great-grandfather was Reverend Ephraim Clark, who was one of the first pastors of Quahog Church, and who came out here originally, as I understand it, to translate the Bible into Hawaiian. And the story is that he translated it from the original Hebrew to Hawaiian rather than and from English. He must have been quite a scholar. And then her family, she had a number of uncles and aunts that all grew up here. So she goes back to 1826. She was a Pinole student. She grew up part of the time on Maui. Her father was a plantation manager at Wailuku, and then he was transferred back here to Aiea Sugar, a Honolulu plantation. And so she moved back down here and went to Pinole and was a boarding student at Pinole until she graduated. And then she went up to Stanford and finished college at Stanford.
And when did you meet?
That's a great story. It was just after the war, and I'd been in the Naval Air Transport Service and was stayed with Pan American World Airways after the war. And so I was stationed down here. And like so many of the young bachelors in town, we went down to check out one of the incoming Matson boats when came in from the mainland and see what came off and who should come ashore. My little Martha Austin, whose family I'd known for a long time. I'd actually met her before, but I didn't know her that well. She was only 12, 13 years old when I first met her, so I asked her for a date. And guess where we went? To the Outrigger Canoe Club. And had dinner, and very shortly after that, I was transferred back to San Francisco to the base up there. And after I'd been there for a while, I decided to write her a letter, and I got a letter back, and it sounded a little encouraging. And so after a couple more letters, I decided to get transferred back to Honolulu, which they obligingly did. And I think I came back in June of 1947, and we were married in August of 47. didn't take very long when we finally made up our minds.
Well, I think we got a little ahead of ourselves here, because I want to go back to your schooling. We got you through high school, and where did you go to college?
After Punahou, I first went to Choate School in Wallingford, Connecticut, which is a prep school. And I graduated from there in 1940 and went to Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, which was probably one of the most fortunate things that ever happened to me. It's a very, very wonderful college. I made a lot of good friends. And I got there bored in 1940. And first year after I was there, of course, the war hit. And I was a sophomore. And so the college life changed considerably. And I eventually finished up by going through in 3 years. So I actually finished my college work in 1943 instead of 44, which was when I should have graduated. And I, like everybody else, particularly from here, after Pearl Harbor, and my brother-in-law was on the West Virginia, which was sunk. He survived, fortunately, but I was pretty wrought up. So a lot of us tried to get into the military, and I didn't have much luck getting into the Navy because my eyes weren't very good. I wanted to be a naval aviator. And after several false starts, I finally found that I could get into the Navy by joining Pan American World Airways. And they had a contract with Naval Air Transport System. So I got a job with Pan Am and went out to San Francisco, with the understanding from the college that as soon as I got my commission that they would send me my diploma. And when I went to get my commission, they said, you don't get your commission until you get your diploma. So I had a catch-22 there, and I finally ended up by taking a left-arm rating as a chief specialist or something of the sort. And I was inactive anyway. I was in a Pan Am uniform, so I spent the rest of the war in the South Pacific and on the West Coast and in Hawaii as a Navy operations officer. And then when the war was over and Pan Am canceled the contract, I stayed with them as an airport manager and control tower operator in several positions there. Till I met Martha, and I was scheduled to go to Bangkok as a station manager in Bangkok. And by that time, she was up high, and I decided that wasn't a very good place to bring up kids, so I resigned from Pan Am, and that's when I went to work for my first job with C. Brewer & Company. Was with the Hilo Transportation and Terminal Company that had just started in Hilo.
Tell us a little bit about your business career.
Well, I got to Hilo in the end of 1947, went to work on the docks there, and I was superintendent of the sugar warehouse, counting sugar bags coming in and counting sugar bags going out to the ship. And then we built the bulk sugar plant, and so we eliminated the sugar warehouse. And I had an offer to go to Hawaiian Agricultural Company in Pahala on the other side of the island. And so in 1949, we moved over there, and I started off as the assistant industrial relations superintendent, and then became the superintendent, and eventually became the industrial engineer for both Hawaiian Ag and Hutchinson Plantation, which was adjacent. And then I came back into the main brewer organization in Hilo as a safety engineer. And I was safety engineer for about 3 years. And then I took over a newly founded training department that they had. We decided that a lot of our supervisors had kind of grown up in the job and didn't really understand what their function was. And so we started a management or supervisory training program, which I directed for a number of years. And about 1962, I was asked to move down to Honolulu to take over the public relations department, which I did. And after about a year there, the original public relations guy, Jack Fox, who I'm sure you know from the statehood days, returned. And so he had been the public relations director previously, and by that time we'd started a new subsidiary company, which was called Hawaiian Agronomics Company International. We were developing agricultural projects in different parts of the world. And it was a brand new organization. There were Actually, when we started, Wayne Richardson and a secretary and I were the total home office staff. Everybody else was overseas. And I was with them for the next 15 years, developing sugar and agricultural projects all over the world, from Iran, Iraq, South America, as much as up to Guadalcanal and Australia, and virtually all parts of the world. It was a fascinating period with Brewer and Company. And eventually, that company was sold, and I'd become vice president of administration by that time. So I went back into the Brewer organization as assistant in the macadamia. We'd bought Montalaw Macadamia Nut Company by then, and I worked in that for a year, and then ended up in the land department managing the resort area up at Punalu on the Big Island beyond the volcano. And that's what I was doing when, as a matter of fact, I was headed for Punalu. Spent the weekend over at Mauna Kea Beach Hotel because it was our anniversary, our wedding anniversary, and I was due to go to Punalu the next day, which I did about every week, and never quite made it. I ended up being flown back to Honolulu instead.
That's a remarkable background.
I was 40 years with Brewer and Company altogether.
40 years?
Yeah.
And then before that, how long were you with Pan American?
Only from 1943 until 1947. Well, I was in the Navy and Pan Am both.
Well, that's 44 years of, you might say, business and military experience.
Yeah.
Combining with 40 years. Well, that's remarkable. Just a question. Have you at any time since your air accident thought of writing an autobiography?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have, Ward. I've written a book about starting with my family and then my own life up until the time I got hurt. That's completed. It's about 400 pages, yeah.
How many pages?
About 400, I think.
And you wrote this after your accident?
Yep, yep. All one finger typing.
Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Well, now, I think we ought to get to that with the canoe club.
Yeah, that's what this is all about, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. When did you join the club?
Well, I'm not really one of the real old-timers. I didn't join until 1943. When I was a kid, Ward, my family had a beach home over at Punalu on this island. And so I kind of grew up over there. We used to go every weekend. And as a result, I never joined the club when I was a kid. I used to go down there a lot. My friend Dick Ward, who lived across the street, was a member. And as a little kid in my sub-teen years, I used to spend quite a bit of time down there. In fact, I think that Malia and Eva began to think that I was a member because I was down there so much. But I just went as a guest. And
well, let me just interrupt there, because there are so many of the current members that you joined in the 40s and the 50s who spent their childhood days at the club as guests.
Yeah.
To say as guests of non-members.
Well, so yeah.
You must have set foot in the club's premises when you were much younger.
Oh, I guess when I was 9 or 10 years old, I started.
What was your first recollection of the club?
Well, you know, one thing that I think back, I remember when there was a little stream that used to run right through between the club and the Moana Hotel. It was, I guess it came down from the Alawai or someplace, but there was a freshwater stream that used to run right across the beach there alongside the club. And they still had the old grass shack, although that wasn't the club itself, but it was still there. In fact, Elmer Lee used to hold forth in there, and I think I started taking steel guitar lessons from him down at the old grass shack.
When did you first learn to surf?
Well, I surfed a little bit as a kid, but actually not. I built a surfboard out of Cam School one summer, and I used to surf over at Kahana Bay on that great big redwood plank.
Yeah.
And I didn't really surf Waikiki very much until I came back here during the war in 1943, and that's when I joined the club. I came in, believe it or not, as a military member. Yeah, I think that was how I joined the club originally. I've forgotten if I was military or they had a special deal with Pan American. In those days, if you worked for Pan Am, you could join the club. So I, as I recall, my initiation fee was $20 or something like that, and I think we paid $1.50 a month for dues, which on my Pan American salary of $150 a month, I could afford. And that's when I first started to use the club a great deal.
So tell us a little about your recollections of your years at the club.
Well, going back before that, one thing that I remember well, Ward, was when we were little kids, we used the same locker room as the big guys. But boy, there was no horsing around like there is in our club now. If you got out of line, you got pinned up against the wall or had a towel flicked at you or something like that. And the kids were really very well behaved compared to what goes on now. I sometimes think that if the members took a little more interest in disciplining the little guys now, that rather than suing the club for malpractice or something of the sort, we'd be better off. Well, during the war, of course, the beach was all covered with barbed wire, and you had to kind of thread your way down through it in order to get to the water. And we still had a wonderful dining room. Our old friend Maxie used to preside over the dining room, I remember.
Oh,
yes. I think you could get a mahi-mahi dinner for $2.10 or something of the sort. So it was a wonderful place to eat. And we used to have dances down there periodically. And you're very popular if you belong to the club, because your friends in the Navy were very happy to be brought down there. And had a surfboard locker, and I remember my first surfboard I was very proud of. I bought it secondhand, and it was a lightweight board. It only weighed 75 pounds. It was one of those balsa redwood strips. And, I was very proud of the fact that I had one of the new light boards. So that's when I really started surfing. And I kept that up until we moved to Hawaii, and then I didn't take it up again until my kid was about 12 years old, and he started surfing, and I decided if I was going to see much of him, I'd do the same, so I went back to surfing then. Aside from that, the club was a bachelor's paradise, you know. There were all kinds of chicks running around in those days, and we knew practically everybody in the club, and used to play volleyball down there. I remember at one point they decided they ought to dig the volleyball courts out because they were getting kind of compacted. So they got a bunch of us down there, and we spent the whole Saturday digging the courts out, and boy, you'd be amazed at what came out of those courts. Everything from horseshoes to gold rings to gosh knows what all. And as I remember, Gay Harris gave us all a steak dinner for our efforts after the thing was all over.
Gay was manager.
I think, yeah, Gay was manager about that time. There was another one that always amused me. There was a guy by the name of Kane. I've forgotten what his first name was.
Oh, yes.
Was manager. And you remember the old entrance to the club was kind of a horseshoe, and the desk was on the inside, and right behind it was the manager's office. And so he had his name on the door, and it just said Kane. And all the local guys, of course, read it as Connie. So they constantly be opening the door and unzipping their fly as they walked in, and poor old Kane was sitting at the desk behind the door.
Connie and Wahine, huh?
Connie Wahine, yeah, and Kane was spelled the same way. I think he finally put Kane manager on it or something like that.
must have had some interesting experiences.
That was when you remember Malia and Eva was there in those days, and gosh, they knew everybody, and it was good fun. It was real kind of relaxed way of life there. The old Al Terrace was a great gathering place.
Remember some of the Beach Boys?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember well that they used to sit around underneath the club. We had the canoe shed under the club, and they were a whole bunch of them. I remember Splash used to sit there playing his... Splash Lyons used to sit there playing his ukulele, and Turkey Love and Panama Dave Baptiste and old Hawkshaw Howell, and Rabbit was there in those days, and Blue Makua and Steamboat Mukwahi, and Sally Hale was... I think he was sort of the head of the beach patrol in those days. He seemed to kind of run things. And then over at the Royal, Jimmy Huckleholy and Chick Daniels ran the operation over there. And oh gosh, there were a lot more of them. I always wondered, Ward, where they got all those names. You know, I don't think there was a single guy on the beach that didn't have some kind of a nickname. Maybe Harry Robello went by his own name, but the rest of them all had these weird names.
That's so true. Blue.
Yeah.
And Ermine. I can recall right off the bat, but there was certainly...
Gosh, I even remember way back before the war, Ward, when the Moana Hotel used to have a sort of a rental thing in the basement, and you could go over there and rent those Moana Hotel bathing suits, those old hairy, itchy things, and you'd see these guys and gals walking up down the beach with those thick wool bathing suits and said Moana across the front of them.
Oh, I remember those. Oh, how well I remember those. Is there any anecdotes that you can recall that happened when you were a youngster or you were a member of the club?
Well, I guess the best thing that ever happened to me at the Outrigger Club was, I told you my first date with my wife was at the club, and it was one of those beautiful moonlight nights, and everything seemed to come together in great shape, and I think I can go back to that great night as the beginning of the romance, which has now lasted for some 45 years.
45 years.